It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickett will be back with me on Wednesday. You're hearing Sledgehammer by Peter Gabriel. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame chose him as one of their inductees for 2014. We'll take your calls in a little bit. Who do you think is the greatest band or performer of all time? Who do you wish or hope is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Is there an underrated band you want to recommend? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to your calls, we'll learn about an announcement that's making waves in the pharmaceutical world. GlaxoSmithKline, one of the largest drug companies in the world, announced they're going to stop hiring doctors to promote their drugs. Where is this coming from? Will other pharmaceutical companies follow suit? We've got Charles Ornstein with us. He's senior health reporter for ProPublica. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So what exactly did GlaxoSmithKline announce today?
Well, GlaxoSmithKline is the first company that announced that it's no longer going to pay physicians to be promotional speakers on behalf of its products, which is a pretty big deal.
And why is that a big deal?
Well, for decades, companies, pharmaceutical companies, have relied on doctors to help sell their products to other doctors. So you've often heard of dinners at fancy restaurants and even trips to resorts, which are now don't really happen. But where doctors have gone and talk to one another about the benefits of various medications. But this practice has been controversial and has come under fire in recent years because pharmaceutical companies have been accused of using doctors to market their products for uses that were not approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
Now, there's not a locked down quid pro quo here. Nobody's got a contract saying you prescribe our drugs 10 more times a month and you get to go to the resort or get this dinner or this speaker's honorarium. But there's a lot of gray area there. Are people seeing this as more or less a kickback?
Well, certainly there's the perception. And a number of academic medical centers, these prominent teaching schools, have banned their faculty from serving on as paid promotional speakers for companies because they sort of view their doctor's role as researching new drugs, not necessarily as white coat marketers. And they see that there's a difference between those two roles. But, you know, what you have to understand is that these drug companies would not spend this money if they didn't get a return on investment. A number of lawsuits filed against the drug companies, big whistleblower lawsuits that have been settled for hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, have found that companies very closely track the return on investment and that they, you know, track doctors prescribing and know just how it changes as a result of the money that they get from a company. And our own analysis at ProPublica has found as well that doctors that receive significant amounts from the pharmaceutical industry are more likely to excessively prescribe brand name drugs than their peers who do not.
But is this that bad? It's not like the doctor is going to give an antidepressant to me if I don't need it, but maybe if I do need it, they might advance that company's over other similar products. That's not harmful to me necessarily.
Well, I think there's a couple of concerns. One is that if a doctor has a conflict of interest, and whether they recognize it or not, they may be more likely to prescribe you a drug, even if you don't need a drug. Hmm. And drugs have side effects, so the idea that a drug won't hurt you is not always true. You know, if there are non-medical ways of trying to address your problem, that's preferable at first, diet and exercise, things like that. Then the second thing is the choice of drug. So there are certain generic drugs that have been on the market for years or even decades. Their side effects are known, their positives are known, their negatives are known. Oftentimes when a new drug comes on the market, people's gut reaction is, oh, it's newer, it must be better. That's not always the case. Sometimes newer drugs haven't been studied as much. When they've been on the market for a short amount of time, some of their more serious side effects come up, and then occasionally they have to be withdrawn from the market. So newer does not always mean better, but it generally means more expensive. And if a doctor is prescribing something that's more expensive, you may have a larger copayment, but it also may be that your insurance company, your employer, or the government has a bigger portion of the tab as well.
GlaxoSmithKline, one of the biggest drug companies in the world, is making this decision. Do you think other pharmaceutical companies are going to follow their lead?
Well, it's hard to say. So here at ProPublica, we have a database called Dollars for Docs. And Dollars for Docs aggregates the payments disclosures that 15 pharmaceutical companies have made publicly about the amount of money that they're paying doctors for things like speaking and consulting and research and meals. And what we've seen over the past 4 years since GlaxoSmithKline has started making its disclosures on the payments to physicians is that they've gone down a lot. They've gone on from about $15 million per quarter in 2009 to about $2.5 million per quarter last year. So that's a drop of 80%. So for Glaxo, the decision to stop us entirely really appears to me to be more evolutionary than revolutionary.
Are other companies tapering off in a similar way?
There are some companies that are going down, and there are some companies that are going up. And it's not just a function of whether their payments are being made public, although I'm sure that that has some effect. A lot of it has to do with the drug product life cycle. So if a company has a drug, has a popular drug that's gone off of patent, it's lost its patent protection, it's gone generic, say like Lipitor, it's not going to invest the same amount of money, any money, into promoting it. Whereas if it has a new drug that's just recently been approved that it wants doctors to prescribe, it will invest more money into promoting it for doctors, into hiring physician speakers. So a lot of the decisions and a lot of them, you know, looking at the money that's invested has to do with a company's product life cycle.
The Affordable Care Act is going to change this, as I understand it, and requires certain standards of transparency on this spending. How is that going to work?
Absolutely, and this is terrific. I mean, going forward, beginning next year, consumers will be able to look up and see whether their physician received money from any pharmaceutical company or any medical device maker. And so it'll be in one central place run by the government, and you'll be able to, you know, look up your doctor and see all of the payments. The reason this is relevant is that right now, when you go into a doctor's office, you have little more than trust, you know, about whether your doctor's doing the right thing and prescribing the right thing for you. If you know that your doctor has a financial relationship, then it's up to you whether you want to ask further questions about it, whether you want to ask if there's a cheaper drug that's available to you or a non-drug alternative, whether you want to ask whether the financial relationship is affecting the doctor's prescribing. We've found that many consumers want this information, and they feel empowered when they have it.
With more transparency, what we have so far with things like your doctor tracking program, and maybe with the new Affordable Care Act, are doctors less likely to want to take this money so they don't show up on these databases?
Sure. Well, once Dollars for Docs came out, what we've heard from doctors is that they don't want to be seen, because when a patient Googles their name, they come up with the reference in Dollars for Docs. So I think there's a lot of doctors that don't want to be seen. There's a lot of academic medical centers that are encouraging their physicians not to do this type of promotional speaking. But I think there are other doctors who are picking up the slack. When we most recently updated Dollars for Docs earlier this year, we found that there were some physicians, one physician, who has earned more than $1 million in speakers' fees from just these companies since 2009, and several others came very close to that. So it's not stopping, you know, doctors that feel that this is appropriate.
Is this an ethics issue for a lot of doctors? Transparency aside, is there a movement among physicians or academics in the medical industry to say, whether you're caught or not, you shouldn't take this money?
I think that there's a deep divide. I think that there's a number of bioethicists who believe it's inappropriate for physicians to have a speaking relationship with drug companies. They say it's perfectly appropriate to be researching new products, to be consulting with drug companies on new research. They just sort of draw the line at the point at which the physician is used as a marketer or where they're providing marketing advice to a company. They think that's sort of an inappropriate role for a physician who should be focusing on the medicine and the research aspects.
Do you see this changing in a direction with less of this kind of less of these kind of payments to doctors?
Well, I think the world is going to change pretty dramatically next year when all companies have to report this information. And I think that you'll see, you know, a huge eye-opening movement among physicians. I think pharmaceutical companies will have to respond based on the way that physicians and the public respond. I think it's a little too early to tell. What we know from Dollars for Docs is that millions of people want access to this information. They've come to our website, and the easier you make it for them and the more context you provide for them, you know, the more they're going to be interested in using this information and selecting doctors and in asking questions for their physicians. And I think after all, I mean, there's so much push as health insurance costs are going up and consumers are responsible for more of those costs. We have to really give people the tools to make better decisions for their own health care, and this is one of those tools.
Charles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Charles Orenstein. He's senior health reporter for ProPublica. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Today, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced its inductees for 2014, including the first year they were eligible, Nirvana, with their breakthrough hit there, Smells Like Teen Spirit. We want to hear from you. Who do you think should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Who do you think is the most underrated rock band of all time? Who do you think's been snubbed, maybe, by critics, the public, and the like? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Here's the list of new inductees, by the way, before you go to your calls. Nirvana, Kiss, Hall & Oates, Peter Gabriel, Linda Ronstadt, and Cat Stevens. Maybe you have some thoughts to share on any of those bands. Some that didn't make it: The Meters, NWA, The Replacements, Deep Purple, LL Cool J, Yes, and The Zombies. 800-642-1234. And we have John in Windsor starting us off. John, hi.
Yeah, hi. I think it's about time Hall & Oates get in. Not for their later stuff like Maneater and that stuff, but like Share a Smile and She's Gone. You know, it's classic soul music. And, you know, the one group that I do not believe is in the Hall of Fame, that is, it's incredible that they're not there, is Chicago. And not with a lot of their, you know, later stuff, but those first two or three albums were really rock fusion, blues, and jazz combined. And I just don't understand how you can... Terry Kath, one of the best guitar players of all time.
Well, and a great horn section, in Chicago.
Exactly.
And I think they got away from that too much in later years. I like the more horn-based stuff early on.
Yeah, that early stuff, you know, 25 or 6 to 4,
right.
You know, a lot of that stuff was really fantastic. So,
well, John, don't hate us. We pulled one Hall & Oates clip. Play what we got, Michelle. What do we pull from? The one song you mentioned. Maneater. Sorry, maybe I gotta dig into their earlier catalog. John, thanks a lot for the call. Listen to a little of Maneater there. Watch out. Oh, different chorus there. I won't try to sing along. Thanks for the call, John. We'll go back to our phones now at 800-642-1234. We've got Shelby in Fountain City. Shelby, hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
Good, real good. Super Tramp. I mean, pianos, they've got strings in their music. You just, you know, I know that's so late 70s, early 80s, but they really, I don't think they're in the Hall of Fame.
I don't think they are, and just a really different sound to that band, too.
Yeah, in fact, I've got all their LPs, 33, of course. I have Breakfast in America and Live from Paris, which was excellent.
All right, well, a great suggestion and a great band, too. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Shelby. I was going to say lines have opened up, but they've filled again. I'll wait to give the phone number again. Thanks, Shelby. We'll go now to Jason in Muskego. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your recommendation?
It blows my mind that Nine Inch Nails is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame yet. Trent Reznor is by far one of the most talented musicians out there, period.
Well, I will agree with you and disagree. I agree with you in that he's a genius. If you look at my selection of CDs and digital, I have more Nine Inch Nails than any other band. But the eligibility requirements, it has to be 25 years after your first album, I want to say about 1990, so I think he's got about 2 years left for eligibility, unless I'm reading the math wrong. So you may get your wish. You may get your wish. I should have said that up front. Yeah.
You know, I'm hoping.
Okay, well, you can start lobbying now for Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails.
Will do.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for the call. Jason, we've got Steve with us now in Ashland. Steve, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story or your band recommendation?
I've got a pretty good story, actually.
All right.
I was at the Hall of Fame in 2010 for a museum conference that was being held there, and
cool.
I got a chance to visit with Lenny Kaye, who's Patti Smith's guitarist and a really fine archivist of sort of garage band music is what Lenny championed.
Huh.
And I visited with him and Terry Stewart, who was director of the Hall of Fame at that time, and we started talking about all the bands that we loved that we thought would never get into the Hall of Fame. And there's a built-in, even Terry agreed, there's a built-in prejudice into the nomination and induction system, and it has a lot to do with popularity and a significant amount with artistic merit. But there's a whole lot of bands out there who were pretty, if you ask people, were really, really influential, but will probably never get there. And I'll mention two and go on. Big Star is an incredible band out of Memphis from the 1970s. Alex Chilton, who was in the Box Tops in the late 60s, was part of Big Star. And you ask anybody from Paul Westerberg and the Replacements to the guys in REM, who one of their formative influences were, and they'll mention Big Star. Hmm. And the other band that I love that'll never get in, but they oughta, represents that great rock and roll scene that was Detroit in the late 60s, early 70s. And even though the Stooges got into the Hall of Fame, if you ask me, the MC5 should be in the Hall of Fame.
So both of those are kind of musicians, though, kind of, is what you're saying, but they don't maybe didn't have the mass appeal that it would take to get in there.
No, that's right. No mass appeal at all whatsoever, but incredible amount of influence from bands like that.
Steve, thanks a lot.
The MC5, I'll just add one more thing on the MC5. There is footage, archival footage, probably on YouTube, of the MC5 playing on a flatbed truck at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Grant Park. They were the house band for the riots. So check out the MC5 on YouTube. They'll blow you away.
All right, Steve, thanks for sharing the stories and the story of your visit to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. To Chuck in Sorona now. Chuck, hi.
Hi. One band that fits all your criteria for sure is the Moody Blues. And they, it's very disappointing that they've never been inducted into the Hall of Fame. They're actually one of the oldest rock bands in existence, having to been together since 1958 in one form or another.
Wow, yeah.
And the band we know from the 60s and 70s, though, well, the post-British invasion band, with Justin Hayward and John Lodge and Graham Edge and those guys had a tremendous influence on things. They released in 1966 the first what you might call progressive rock concept album. And went on from there to, for instance, in Australia, they had...
Well, I want to get one more caller in, Chuck, but thanks for the Moody Blues recommendation. We have Dave in Wanakee with some recommendations as well. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hi. There's two guitar players that definitely should be in there that aren't. One is Link Wray. He had the first instrumental number one hit for rock and roll with Rumble, and he influenced tons of guitar players, many, many more than, say, Eric Clapton did. Another one is, hard to believe, but Dick Dale isn't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, two very influential, and in a way, those are another couple of musicians, right? They inspired a lot of people, but maybe weren't the mass pop sensations that some of the other Hall of Fame bands might be.
Yeah, it seems like you have to have a lot of record sales to get in there. So maybe it should be Rock and Roll Hall of Record Sales.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Dave, and the suggestions. You can keep your suggestions going on the Central Time Facebook page. Bands you think should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, bands you're glad are already there, ones you're hopeful for the future. By the way, here are some that will be eligible next year, thanks to our producer, Galen. We've got Garth Brooks, Green Day, Bare Naked Ladies, and Annie DeFranco. So there's just a few. And again, you can share yours on the Central Time Facebook page. And oh, and the ones that didn't make the cut this time. Meters, NWA, Replacements, Deep Purple, LL Cool J, Yes, and the Zombies. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up, it's our Teach Me What You Know segment. Today, we'll learn how to winterize a house. Winter is coming. Well, it's already here. But our guest says it's not too late to save energy and money. First, a lot of cable TV shows have risen to dominate conversations and award shows over the years. The new Golden Globe and Screen Actors Guild nominations have lots of Breaking Bad and some Game of Thrones. That's the theme song we're listening to there. Our next guest sees parallels to these shows in an unexpected place, the novels of 1800s England. Caroline Levine is professor of English at UW-Madison. I talked to her a while back about these TV shows. Caroline Levine, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rob.
Well, my question is, we've got an expert on Victorian culture and literature. Why the heck are you teaching classes and writing about Mad Men and The Wire and other TV shows?
Well, you know, there's a surprising similarity between the Victorian novel and contemporary television that I am really struck by as a Victorian lit scholar. They go through a kind of similar transformation. So the Victorian novel used to be considered trashy, addictive, bad for people's brains, bad for their sense of ethics. So exactly the way that TV has been treated by us in our culture, we think of it as low and degraded and popular and trashy. And then over the course of the 19th century, novelists started to experiment with really complex, multi-plot novel forms that wove together different characters to give a whole vision of society, and the novel started to be taken seriously. And that, I think, is what's happening with TV right now. So HBO gave a lot of room to directors and producers to think much more ambitiously about what TV could do. And DVD technology allowed us to watch something from the very beginning, even if we'd missed, you know, even if we heard about it in the middle, we can go back now and watch from the very beginning. And so they can weave together much more complicated plots that bring together different parts of society and allow us actually to think about the society that we live in really rich and deep ways. And so it's a lot like Dickens, for example, or George Eliot, to think about how whole societies work.
And I've heard shows like The Wire especially referred to as Dickensian, as how they weave together all those elements. I mean, is that a fair comparison, or do people overstate that?
You know, I'm one of the champions of that view. There are definitely people who disagree with it. but I see The Wire as really building on Dickens's project, which was to try to figure out how to see a whole social world as interconnected. How is it that I am linked, you know, I'm a professor in the university. How am I linked to somebody living in dire poverty in my own city, but somebody I'll never meet? And Dickens cared about that, and The Wire really tries to get us to see how that works.
We'll dig a little deeper into that, but I want to get back to this idea of the novel as like the trash of the day.
Yeah. Right?
It was really looked down on, huh?
Definitely. If you had daughters, you were supposed to keep novels from them because it would turn them into, first of all, muddleheads, right? It would just be completely bad for their brains. But also, it would train you to think that there was this world of fantasy out there and that you should live in this world of fantasy. And so there was an argument that it was really bad for people. There were always a few novelists who kind of rose above the fray. And so one of the struggles in the novel in the early 19th century is between a sense of a really feminized world of novels. So there were more women writers of novels and more women readers of novels in the late 18th century. And then Walter Scott comes along and he kind of masculinizes the novel and dignifies the novel also for some people.
So when dudes came along and started writing the serious novels, then people started taking them seriously?
Kind of. I mean, there were definitely male writers of the novel in the 18th century too, but it's when people think of it as a feminine genre that it's really degraded and low. And so it's a bunch of really concerted efforts to say, no, this could be a more serious genre than you realize.
Well, is there an analogy in TV now, I wonder? Because, you know, is The Wire, The Sopranos, are those like guy things and we take them seriously? I don't know. I'm thinking out loud here.
That's a really great question. I think maybe there's not an analogy there. Although it's really true. You know, I actually have a kind of prejudice against shows that don't have strong women characters, but The Wire doesn't really. I mean, a couple along the way, but it's not centered around women. So it does in some ways feel like a kind of masculine show. But I think TV was never quite feminized that way. It was maybe, if anything, made people think about childishness, right? That TV was easy and it didn't challenge you rather than women.
So we're in a transformation period now where what used to be TV was, you know, popular for the masses, here today, gone tomorrow. And now more and more, if you want to have that serious conversation about our culture, it's not the latest book or even the latest movie. It's the TV shows.
I think we're you know, there are a lot of people who would disagree with me, but I think we're in a golden age of television as art. I think what film can't do what television can do because it just doesn't have enough time. So if you really want to try to think about complicated interrelations between people, you're better off working in TV. And now TV is taking itself seriously. It's giving room to that kind of real thoughtfulness. So the novel is still doing that. And the novel is still, I think, a really important and popular form. But I'm pretty sure we're going to look back on this moment and say, wow, TV was extraordinary then.
Is part of the deal with these shows coming up that there are so many different networks and so many opportunities to experiment, whereas back in the day when you had three and then four broadcast networks and maybe public television, there wasn't room for that? They had to have this wide, lowest common denominator feel?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I you know, in some ways I'm sad for the loss of the common culture that we had through networks and for the sense, you know, that news channels were not competing in the same ways that they are now, using kind of, you know, cheap marketing tactics to get people to watch and that kind of thing. So it's sad for me to say yes to that question. But in some ways, it's true. HBO, I think, was really smart and savvy, but also thoughtful about allowing television to expand its usual array of themes and problems to things that were disturbing, that were graphic, that were sexual, all kinds of things that, you know, you actually really can't show on the networks. And there's a good reason why you can't. And so you do actually need cable channels to make that happen.
We've kind of lost that common conversation we had, you know, back in the day. I remember everybody saw that last episode of MASH. Not everybody, of course, but there were things that such a huge portion of the population saw. It really dominated the conversation for a while. We're never going to see that again, are we?
No, right. And especially the way that culture is delivered to us, which is often, you know, Netflix or on DVD, right? We don't have that synchronous timing where the water cooler the next morning, everybody gathers and talks about the same thing. But, you know, the flip side and the good side of that is a lot of diversification. There's more options for people. And, you know, I think the long extended plot is made possible also by these new technologies. And that, as I was saying before, is something really valuable for us.
Now, some of the shows we've mentioned, The Wire has come up, and there are shows like Mad Men, The Sopranos, lots of others. They're really exciting to people in my circles, in the media, in academia. Is there sort of an elitism here or a snob appeal and it's not going to the rest of the culture?
Yeah. To some extent, I think that's true. This is high art television, so it actually isn't for everybody. I have a couple of friends who are TV scholars, and I thought I was going to get, you know, some credibility from them because I was writing about The Wire, and they said, oh, highbrow television, right? So I do think TV's ideas of itself and its markets and its ways of conceiving itself is kind of splitting into different demographics, and that this is highbrow television. But like a lot of art forms, that doesn't mean it necessarily leaves other people out. So it can be challenging, difficult, interesting, and rich without being exclusive.
Mm-hmm. It's not highbrow. It's just it's longer and more convoluted.
Right. Right. So you have to have a willingness to commit to it, to watch it through.
So The Wire, you've talked about some. Can you leave us with a couple other shows that really sum up what we're talking about that are reinventing the early days of the Victorian novel in our time?
Sure. So I like to think of – I know for a lot of people both The Sopranos and Breaking Bad have been groundbreaking, and I certainly would love to give them credit. But for me, the three that kind of sum up the different directions that television could take in these rich new ways are The Wire, Mad Men, and Game of Thrones. Because there are all these different genres, and in each genre, television is expanding how we think. It's complex, it's rich, it's resonant, but it shows us this huge range of possibility that's out there.
Caroline Levine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for letting me be here.
That was Caroline Levine, UW professor of English. We're going to learn how to save energy and keep our homes more comfortable during the winter. It's the latest segment in our Teach Me What You Know series. Adam Wisey is with us. He's assistant field supervisor with Project Home. It's a nonprofit serving Dane and Greene counties that assists about 1,000 households each year with a variety of no-cost and low-cost home improvement programs, like, I imagine, winterizing. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So we're a little late here, but I am always late to this sort of thing. What are some things we can do right now to start winterizing our home?
Well, the biggest thing is to make sure that all of your doors and windows are in operable condition and that they close and open properly. The windows, the biggest problem is probably the double hung windows. And if they're not locked at the sash properly, that top sash tends to ride down. And if you haven't looked at it since summer months, it's open.
It sounds like a little thing. How big a difference can that make?
Well, the biggest improvement that any homeowner can make to their home is ensuring that their home is insulated and air sealed. So making sure that you don't have those outside air leaks coming in is really important.
Suppose we've got some leaks and we've done what we can, but it's still leaking. We're probably not going to get the windows replaced midwinter like this. What kind of things can we do then?
Sure, certainly. One of the easiest things and most widely available would be to get the plastic window insulating kits, and it's really a window air sealing kit. They're really effective at stopping outside drafts, and they're easy to install. They have everything they need right in the kit, and as long as you have a good tight seal all the way around the perimeter, when you put it on, it'll work really well.
I've done those before. I know you're supposed to get them so they're perfectly flat. Mine are always a little wrinkly. Does that ruin the impact, or does it still help a little?
As long as it's sealed all the way around the perimeter, it's really not that big of a deal.
My one main winterizing tactic over the years has been rope caulk. I'm the king of rope caulk. I still do it on some windows. I had a very poorly insulated room that, thankfully, we've insulated now. And can that make a difference, a little rope caulk here and there?
Absolutely. Rope caulk would do a really good job at stopping those outside air leaks. Regular tube caulk and a caulk gun as well. They make peelable caulks that you can remove seasonally, so your windows aren't sealed shut permanently.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
the other thing that you can do is
blanking on it there. We can come back to it. That's okay.
Yep.
So outside the windows, what are some other – and you mentioned doors, of course. So what can we do if we've got a door that doesn't quite seal as well?
Right. You can just check and make sure that the door is not warped, that that the weather stripping is intact around it. If you tend to get drafts underneath the doors,
right,
at the threshold, and a lot of widely available door sweeps, easy to install with a screwdriver and some screws. So that's really effective. Sometimes doors don't close fully, so you can adjust the strike plate or the latch and make sure that they close a little tighter to seal them up better.
I've seen people have those, they're kind of like door-length pillows that they just lay out in front of the bottom when they've got that gap at the bottom. Are those fairly effective?
They are effective. And again, it's that whole same principle of stopping that air leak.
So yeah, that's the key, is stopping the air movement. If there's any kind of breeze, it's really, really hurting us there.
That's correct.
So outside of the doors and the windows, that air movement, taking a look at our furnaces, boilers, our HVAC system, or I guess it's just the H is the important bit there.
It's important this time of year.
Uh-huh.
Really, you don't want to lose sight of the V in HVAC either,
which ventilation.
Is ventilation, because when you tighten these houses up in the wintertime, you do have to manage the moisture in them. So running that bath fan when you're showering, leaving it on after you're done, just to make sure that you don't get excessive condensation on the windows or any excess moisture is really a potential for a mold problem down the road. So it's important to keep that in mind. But back to the heating system, just having a qualified HVAC company come out and check over your system, either annually or every other year, as long as you haven't had any damage to it or changes, that's really important. Making sure that all the vents are unobstructed, the intake and the exhaust for your furnace, water heater. Trim back bushes, make sure the snow is cleared away from the vents. That's all really important. Replacing systems is on a grander scale, but again, that's That's more of a long-term thing and or an emergency thing.
I was going to say, in the winter, we're probably just going to do that in emergency situations. But as we're evaluating how our furnace is working looking ahead to the spring, we don't need the heater, and that's the time to replace it. What should we be thinking about? When should we make the call? Like, it's still, you know, technically working, but maybe it needs to go.
Every household's going to be different, and it's a matter of what their budget is. And it's important to keep in mind there are some great resources in Wisconsin to help out with that. For more vulnerable populations, low to moderate income households, there is an emergency heating system replacement and repair program in Wisconsin. So if you are in a household that qualifies for energy assistance, that is an option for you. At least that'll keep you limping along through the rest of the heating season. The Focus on Energy offers a lot of rebates. They have a great website at www.focusonenergy.com, and it's important to check that out if you're thinking of replacing a heating or air conditioning system. There are a lot of qualified contractors that work through Focus on Energy who've had extensive training to install these systems properly and set them up to make sure they're running correctly and efficiently. And all that info can be found on focusonenergy.com.
And the goal there, it's kind of a double goal. It seems like you replace the old system that's really inefficient, and you take advantage of newer energy-saving technology. So partly the old system is old, and that's why it's bad. Partly it hasn't taken advantage of that newer technology, right?
That's true. Yep.
And how about humidifying? I've heard that makes a house feel warmer. It makes it obviously feel less dry, and that's a benefit in itself. Does running a humidifier help with our energy efficiency or perception of warmth in some way?
It's more of a perception of warmth. The warm air can hold a greater quantity of heat. The moist air can hold a greater quantity of heat, rather. I'm not a big fan of the humidifiers. When we're looking at homes to make them more energy efficient, you have to tighten up that building shell, the walls, the attics, the basements, the crawl spaces. And as you do that, the home tends to retain more moisture, which over time can be a big problem in some households. The number one cause of building failure across the United States is moisture problems.
Interesting. Something I got to watch out for in my house. Something I always wonder when I'm looking at my roof from outside and seeing the melting patterns of snow, seeing the icicles, knock on wood, we don't get ice dams this year. Are there things as we look at our rooftop that should make us wonder, do I need to change something either now or when I can get in there over the summer?
Yeah, down here we recently had a light dusting of snow. And as you drive around town, you can see where that snow is melting on the roof is where the heat is being lost in the attic. The biggest thing you can do there is probably – it's a little daunting for most homeowners to go up in the attic and find these holes in their building shell and seal them up. But, again, Focus on Energy – there's a lot of qualified contractors, home performance specialists, building analysts. If you suspect you have a problem or if you look up at your roof and you see all the snow is melted off and you have icicles or ice dams, it's probably a good idea to call someone in and help you out with that.
Let's go from the top of the house to the ground level. How big, there's that basement, there's the foundation peeking up there. How big a source is that for heat loss? Is that a good place to get insulated?
That's a good place to get insulated because it's accessible in most homes for most homeowners. Again, getting into the attic spaces is not an option for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But most people can go down in their basement, look at the top of their foundation, and where the floor joists meet the foundation, there's these little boxes up there. Now, they should have insulation in them. If they don't, they need insulation in them. So you want to either put fiberglass or any other type of insulation in there that fits tightly. Make sure you seal up any air leaks. So if you have a lot of plumbing, electrical penetrations through there, caulk those shut first before insulating, because, again, you'll get problems with moisture.
So other tips that we haven't hit, anything with hot water pipes or anything like that?
Absolutely. You don't want to forget about the water heater. So they sell sticks of pipe insulation. They sell water heater blankets. All these things are really effective at slowing the heat loss from your water heater tank and through the pipes. So go ahead, put that on, follow the manufacturer's instructions, and check your water heater's warranty to make sure you're not voiding the water heater warranty by putting a blanket around the tank.
Can you give us some insight into how much money we're talking about saving when we do some of this stuff? Or I know it, we've talked about a wide variety of things that might be arranged, but is it worth it? Do these things pay off in the long run?
These things really pay off in the long run, especially as fuel prices continue to rise going down the road. Again, the most cost-effective stuff to do would be the insulation and the air sealing. That's going to save money immediately. It's going to improve comfort in the home, increase your building durability, and create a more safe and healthy environment to live in. So, you know, that's been a benefit immediately. There's, you know, the high efficiency heating system will pay off over time generally, but it's going to take a long time to pay off. So the bigger bang for your buck would be the insulation and the air sealing.
You mentioned Focus on Energy and their help that they can provide, Wisconsin Energy Assistance and Weatherization. What kind of things do you do at Project Home for senior and low-income residents?
Well, we do all that work we talked about. So we provide energy assessments through the Low-Income Weatherization Program in the state of Wisconsin. And again, we serve Dane County and Greene County. All 72 counties in Wisconsin are covered by an agency like Project Home in the weatherization network. So you can check that out at www.homeenergyplus.wi.gov. And there's a map showing all the energy assistance providers for each county. And that's where you'd get the ball rolling to see if you qualify for that.
So if people are getting sticker shock at some of these improvements we've talked about, that's a good place to start.
If you are in need and you have limited resources. Otherwise, I would start with focusonenergy.com. There's a great link there called Find It with Focus. You can enter your zip code in and enter what service you're looking for. You can look up HVAC contractors, building analysts, energy auditors, insulation companies. There's a lot of great resources on finditwithfocus.com.
And those plastic window kits and the caulk we talked about, a pretty cheap way to get started.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Adam Wisey. He is Assistant Field Supervisor with Project Home, a nonprofit serving Dane and Greene counties that assists about 1,000 households each year with some of the things we've been talking about in other home improvement programs. Our next Teach Me What You Know segment, another winter weather tip. Ice fishing. It's coming up in a couple weeks.